Okay, so welcome to lecture 13. We're going to talk about algorithms today, parallel algorithms. And you know what, you can have an entire class to talk about parallel algorithms. Parallel algorithms is a kind of an area where many, many clever people spend their lifetime trying to figure out how to be more creative and more effective. And if you're interested in this kind of topic, you know what, you should really go into the literature, and you will find hundreds and hundreds of papers. And many of these things are also domain specific, meaning that if you are interested in a particular type of application, such as let's say n-body problem, it turns out that the particular kind of algorithm that you will use is very different if you're applying n-body problem to astronomy, or you're applying the n-body problem to molecular dynamics, or you're applying n-body problem to computer gaming. Okay, so they're all very different. The reason is the nature of the data in astronomy is very different from the nature of data in molecular dynamics. So oftentimes people will have very different creative ways of organizing computational steps and data, even data structure, to exploit the nature of the data and then get better results. So I'm going to go a little bit into this kind of stuff today, and it's going to take several lectures and even some of the case studies for you to probably fully appreciate the extent of latitude that these algorithms can have when people design algorithms. So let's start from some of the basics so that we can actually have a meaningful conversation in the rest of the semester. So this slide 2 kind of shows the roadmap that we showed last time. We talked about the concurrency in the problems last time. So this time, we're going to kind of focus on how you can structure your algorithm to translate some concurrency into performance. And you should expect that most of the material that we're talking about today is really foundational, okay? Meaning that we're setting up some of the basic terminologies and some of the basic concepts for you to be able to start to appreciate the various algorithm tricks that people play in the field, and that hopefully that will kind of boost you into a position where you can start to talk about talk with experienced parallel programmers, and understand the kind of strategies that they often take. And algorithms are very different from what we call the detailed performance tuning, but they're related. Now, oftentimes you will run into a situation where your program is not running very well, okay? And sometimes you get lucky and you find out there's a little bit of tweaking in the code that you can do to improve the performance. But oftentimes these kind of things require surgery. Surgery means that you need to somehow rearrange the way you do computation at a conceptual level, or sometimes you need to even rearrange the nature of the data, okay, the arrangement of your data, in order to overcome these performance issues. So that's why people often say, if you don't understand exactly what the algorithm does, you can still try to improve the performance by tweaking things here and there. But oftentimes you will get much, much better results if you understand the computational steps being taken by the algorithm and understand the flexibility in some of these things so that you can rearrange the conceptual steps taken by these algorithms and get better performance. So what is an algorithm? Most of you have taken algorithm courses, so I'm not going to teach the basic algorithms. But there was an interesting proposal. I'm involved in a working group to modernize computer science curriculum. And one of the things that we talk about is, maybe we should start to talk about parallel algorithms right from the first, computational course. So, you know, right from the beginning of the algorithms and data structures, we should begin to talk about parallelism. So we're still debating, we're still trying to figure out, you know, if that's feasible. But, you know, maybe we can, in this course, you know, I'm going to kind of just go and refresh your memory a little bit. You know, so for those of you who have not taken, you know, a kind of a formal computer science data structure and algorithm course, algorithm has become a very common word in our society now, right? And oftentimes people say, you know, what is the algorithm for this thing? And really what they're saying is, you know, well, how do I take steps to, you know, to finish, you know, a little bit more systematic way of carrying out a particular task. So, you know, in the most loose way, it is, you know, supposed to be a well-defined sequence of steps that you can take, right, to accomplish a job. So, you know, naturally in computer, you know, this is actually a mathematical term, you know, when they started, it's a step-by-step procedure that is guaranteed to terminate, okay? And you will have certain kind of computation that will never terminate. For example, you know, if you have, you know, some kind of a cell phone, you know, a cell phone that has a user interface, that user interface should never terminate. It should be always on when you turn on the phone. It should be always there. So that particular computation will never finish. It's an infinite loop, and that's by design. Okay. And so, but it's not an algorithm. An algorithm is really designed to accomplish something. Okay. So there's a well-defined end to that computation. And you know what, each step should be stated precisely so that it can be carried out by a computer. So in our daily life, sometimes we, you know what, we call something algorithm and it's not. For example, you know what, if you do house cleaning, you know, if you have these kids, you know, at home, you know what, you go into the room and yell and say, okay, clean up your desk. And you know what, it may be somewhat well defined, you know what, but it's really not so well defined. Okay, there are all kinds of different ways of cleaning up the desk, you know, throwing everything into the garbage can versus, you know, shoving everything into the drawer, or, you know, there are all kinds of things that kids can do. And you know, we cannot tolerate that little bit of a, you know, inconsistency. But in a computer program, you really need to have a well-defined, you know, step. And every time the computer does that, it should be exactly the same result, you know, within some kind of acceptance criteria. So, you know, so that requires what we call the, you know, definiteness, the notion that each step is precisely stated, okay? And you know, there shouldn't be any kind of room for, you know, interpretation. Oh, maybe, you know, maybe it should be done this way, maybe it should be done that way. And whenever something like this happens, it's a bad algorithm specification. Okay, you need to refine it so that there's no such, you know, kind of room for wiggling. And effective computability, each step can be carried out by a computer. So if you define a step that cannot be, you know, carried out by a computer, such as, you know, just go and clean up the room, then it becomes, you know, not an algorithm, it becomes artificial intelligence or natural intelligence, right? And also, you need to make sure that it's finite. The procedure actually terminates, okay? So it turns out that, you know, whenever you look at a problem, whenever you have a problem such as molecular dynamics and so on, you can have numerous algorithms that would solve that problem. Then in general, problems are related to real world, okay, hopefully. You know, the kind of problems that you're gonna solve should have some kind of correspondence to real world. And in real world, the nature is such that you don't need to necessarily do certain things in a particular way. There are multiple ways of achieving similar effects. But given a particular algorithm, it should be very well defined, you know, how the computation is done. So each of these multiple algorithms for solving the same problem, sometimes some of them can require fewer steps. Okay, you know, in many ways, when we teach computer science courses, in the past, you know, I'd say 30 years, a lot of the course in algorithms, a lot of these education algorithms have to do with teaching clever ways of doing, taking fewer steps, okay, in order to achieve the same thing. And cleverness is related to fewer steps. And if you can take fewer steps, you can use fewer lines to specify the same thing. You're more clever, you get higher grade. Okay, so that's kind of the fundamental mindset of these courses. And it turns out that, you know, some of these algorithms can exhibit more parallelism. You may actually need to do more work in order for the algorithm to have parallelism, to be able to execute these steps in parallel. And oftentimes, there's a very, very intricate trade-off that you need to make. And, you know, in almost all the parallel algorithms that I see, you know, in real world, there's always a point where you need to decide how much additional work you're willing to do in order to get more parallel, you know, all the steps to be able to do, execute in parallel. And that's the part that we have not really taught in most of the computer science, you know, programming courses. And some actually have larger memory footprint than others. And this is even farther away from some of the computer science courses up to this point. Every algorithm has a memory footprint. That means every algorithm has a particular way of using the memory, okay? It has a footprint of how big a memory it takes to hold the data. And some of these algorithms require more memory because they need to get data to spread out in order to for the parallel execution to stay out of each other's way. Some of them have heavier footprint in dragging data in and out of the processor into memory and back from memory. And that you know, consumes bandwidth and so on. And it's just like us. Every one of us has a different footprint in terms of how we use the resources. Some of us don't turn off the lights when we leave the office. That's a bigger footprint than others, okay? So, you know what, depending on the way you handle things, depending on your philosophy, you would end up using more energy or less energy, you know, as we, you know, live. So all these things, you know what, essentially leading to, you know what, your ability to organize your computation in such a way that you hopefully will have, you know, a good trade-off between amount of work you do and the amount of parallelism you do that you have, and then you have a way to argue and to design these things in terms of the memory footprint that these algorithms will have. So we already actually talked a little bit about some of these things in bits and pieces in the previous lectures. So one of the things I kind of wanted to do better this semester is to actually take some, you know, these, you know, two general lectures and link them back better into the CUDA model that you have learned so far. So you know what? Here is a little bit of a this is a picture that we that I actually took from Mattson and you know, and so on in that parallel algorithm patterns book. So. You know, this is actually a very nice picture that highlights the most important aspects of structuring a parallel algorithm, okay? And, you know, it does capture the essence of, you know, the work that you're going to do when you design your algorithm. The first one aspect is the organization of your algorithm. How do you actually organize parallelism in your program? And in general, there are two kinds of useful patterns. Okay, patterns. And this is the first time I kind of used this word in this course in a sort of a you know, in a non-casual way. Patterns are defined in many different ways. And if you talk to Ralph Johnson in this department, he would just frown at me for, you know, for using the word pattern in a loose way. You know, he would say a pattern is a well-documented, you know, a way of doing some things, and you know, you it's a language, it's da 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 da. So I'm using pattern as a, you know, much less, you know, rigorous sense. A pattern is actually just a very commonly seen approach that people take to do a certain to do certain things. So you know, a organizational, you know, organizationally, there are two very frequently used patterns in for people to organize their parallel algorithm. One is linear pattern, and one is recursive pattern. Linear pattern means that you take the amount of work that you do, okay? You take the amount of work you do, and you just kind of chop them up into chunks, okay? It doesn't have to be one dimension. It can be two-dimensional, three-dimensional, but, you know, it's, in general, it's you take a knife, and you just chop, you know, chop them up into these chunks. And each chunk is, you know, what, executed in parallel with other chunks, right? So that's linear pattern. And you know what, in general, we refer to this as task parallelism, okay? Meaning that it's very straightforward to look at the kind of work that you do and relate that to the original, okay? Very easily relate back to the original work that you're supposed to do, and you say, oh, all these are just kind of chopped up little chunks that, you know what, I have. And the other one is also extremely popular, which is, you know, recursive. And this is divide and conquer. So what happens is that oftentimes you see a task, and instead of just, you know, go and then chop it up, you know, in straight, you know, straightforward way, you say, oh, you know what, I need to actually, you know what, do a little bit of divide. And then so I will take a few steps to divide up the tasks. So you know, in the first round I divided into two parts, and the second round I divided into four parts, and I go all the way down until I refine the size of my, you know, my task in to a reasonable size. And this oftentimes is used when you have extremely big data set. A dynamic data set, meaning that you don't really know how big these things are until you actually dig a little bit into it. Okay, so it's not something that you necessarily can tell right up front. And you know what, for those of you who wonder, you know, what static and dynamic means, you know what, I can give you a very simple example. So you know what, I didn't fully realize, you know, what dynamic, you know, task generation means until I went to Connecticut one year and helped my sister to, you know, to fix her house. So this is a 200-year-old, you know, nice, very nice house near in New Haven, Connecticut. Nice house, but there is a little bit of a problem. The problem is the plumbing is also 200 years old, right? So you know what, she had a kind of a toilet leak, right? So you know what, and then she said, hey, you know, you're an engineer, you can fix this. So you know, I said, sure, you know, I'm an engineer, I can fix this. So you know, I look at the toilet and there's nothing, you know, there's nothing special about it, right? So you know, I said, no problem, okay, here's the task, you know, I'll complete the task by noon, okay? It was 10 o'clock in the morning and I already gave it myself a little bit buffer, right? So I open up the lid, I look at it, I said, oh, you know, it's just, you know, here's a little, you know, here's this rubber thing that needs to be replaced. So that was good, right? So, you know, I shut off the, you know, the water, and then, you know, I drained the, you know, drained the tank, and then I took out the rubber, and I went to Home Depot, right? And, you know, I was already singing my victory song until the guy says, oh, we don't have this kind of rubber anymore. They discontinued it about 20 years ago or something, right? And then so he said, I said, okay, so what? Tell me what to do. He said, okay, I have this thing, okay? This thing that includes the rubber, right? You go home and replace this thing, you know, with what I have. So, okay, no problem, you know, engineering, you know? So it's a little bit change of plan, but it's not bad, right? So I took that thing back to my sister's house, and I took that thing into the tank, and I realized that the socket is different from the thing that I have. So I took out that socket, the whole thing from the socket, right, and back to Home Depot, right? And you know what? The same helpful person looked at it and smiled and said, oh, this was discontinued 30 years ago as well. And you know, you need to have this thing. So he gave me a much bigger thing and said, maybe this thing will help, right? So I returned that thing and got a bigger thing and then brought it home. And you know, sure enough, that bigger thing doesn't fit, right? So the tank was not wide enough to fit that thing. So you know what? So I finally, you know, I went back to the guy, and the guy says, let me tell you what you're going to have. At that point, he actually has a very clear vision about what I'm dealing with. He said, you know, you need to replace the whole tank. But before you go buy that tank, let me tell you, you know what? I have 90% confidence that the piping out of the wall into the wall into the toilet is not going to work with this tank. Okay, so, you know, let me give you a very important advice, young man, at this point. Here is a number of a contractor that you can call, right? And, you know, this is probably the most inexpensive, honest guy in the area. If you call this guy, in about a few weeks, you know, this toilet will be fixed, okay? So this is what I call true dynamic tasks, okay? You work into something, you keep discovering things, and then you have more or less cost, you have more or less time, right? And you know what? Not all the computing tasks are static, meaning that before you call a function, before you say, you know, go process this data structure, you already know exactly how much work there is. Oftentimes, you need to actually go and work on things a little bit, and then you will see some new work, and then you discover some, you know, some things that need to be taken care of. You create some new work. And therefore, oftentimes, divide and conquer is used rather than doing linear chopping, because oftentimes you need to solve the problem and divide the problem into a certain, you know, to a certain level before you even see all the work that, you know, needs to be done. And that's why, you know, it's called recursive, okay? Now, you also need to think in terms of data, okay? In other words, data oftentimes need to be decomposed into smaller chunks so that the parallel tasks can actually get out of each other's way. So if you don't organize your data properly, you can have an algorithm that has a lot of parallelism, but they keep getting into each other's way. They keep, you know, trying to dip into each other's data, and you need to find a way to coordinate them. If you are doing input sharing, you know what, it may be a good thing because you have shared memory, you have constant memory kind of stuff. But if you have something that keeps writing into someone else's data, then you have endless trouble, right? So oftentimes you need to organize data by doing some decomposition. Also, data has the nature of dynamic versus static, okay? So, you know what, you can have a linear data partitioning if your data is more or less static and also more or less uniformly distributed. So what is a uniform distribution? If you have, you know, something like a molecular dynamic simulation, and you're trying to simulate a solvent, right? You know, with, you know, some molecules in a solvent. And if you look at a solvent, if you look at the water molecules versus the, you know, the whatever molecules, you know what, there are molecules all over the place, right? There's, so you know what, it's a relatively uniform distributed, you know, system. What is a non-uniform distributed system? If you are working on astronomy, okay, you also have a lot of these particles. All these particles are stars and the heavenly bodies, right? And these things are not fundamentally different from molecules and atoms, okay? They're not fundamentally different when it comes to computation. But they tend to be very sparsely distributed in the space, okay? That oftentimes you have a big chunk of space that has nothing, and then you have a whole cluster of something, you know what, that you need to model. So whenever you have a data like that, you tend to use, you know, recursive data structures rather than linearly partitioned data structures. Linearly partitioned data structures works well when you have roughly the same amount of data in each area, so that when you just do a linear partition, uniform partition, you end up with about the same amount of work because you end up with about the same amount of data. But if you have the same strategy for astronomy, oftentimes you will end up chopping out things into the chunks where you really don't have much going on, and then you have chunks where a lot of things are going on. And that's really, really bad because you don't no longer have a good spread out of data and therefore work for all the parallel threads. So that's why if you look at data structures, you will see dramatically different data structures for what we call the n-body problem in general. Okay, the n-body problem says in a system I have a large number of these particles, and we call them bodies, right? And we simulate the interaction across these bodies. And if these bodies come from astronomy, you tend to have these tree-like data structures. That essentially, the data structure itself is organized into trees, and these tree, branches actually signify the partition of your space. So you take the sky, you partition it into two parts, right? So then, within that part, you're going to partition them into smaller and smaller parts. However, if you have a situation where you have a big chunk of sky that has nothing going on, you don't further partition it, okay? You leave that part as a big partition. Whereas the neighbor may have a large number of these clusters of stars and so on, then you further partition them into smaller parts. So that in the end, when you look at the recursive data at the bottom where you deliver these things into computation, you will actually have small chunks of sky and big chunks of sky, but hopefully all these things contain roughly the same number of stars, right, for you to to process. So that's why if you look at games, computer games, oftentimes they also have these spatial data structures, which essentially is the same thing, okay? But in the games, oftentimes you will have very busy activity areas, and then you have background. So that's why you will also use the astronomy-like data structure. And so one of the very frequently used tree is KD tree. And go online and search for these algorithms. And once you understand why all these data structures exist, they all exist because you need to have a flexible way of partitioning your space in such a way that you can have roughly the same amount of work for each parallel task. So you can actually have an interaction between the data and the task, okay? You can actually have a task parallelism processing a recursive data structure. It's not the best fit, but sometimes it may be the best you can have, okay? And I'm going to actually show you one example. You already have seen one of them. Ideally, you would like to have a recursive task structure coupled with a recursive data decomposition. That's a perfect match, but oftentimes you'll end up doing some compromise because your programming model, because your hardware is limited. They only provide task parallelism, so you need to somehow twist your data recursion into a task linear partition task structure. That's essentially what you do in CUDA when you need to handle some of these KD trees and so on. Okay, that's essentially what happens. Now, there's also a data flow organization. So what we have been talking about is kind of the organization of the work that you need to do. And then you have the organization of the data that you need to process. Oftentimes, there's also a communication, pattern. How do you actually have information that is generated by one task, okay, and consumed by one or more tasks? So this, this is a very, you know, a common situation where you have, you know, multiple steps, right, that you need to take in order to, you know, finish the algorithm. So when you have an information flow, you also can have two major patterns, okay? One pattern is, again, more regular, called pipeline. It's a very frequently used pattern, and what that means is one step of your algorithm will produce, okay, will produce a kind of a, you know, a deterministic or some kind of predetermined amount of data that will be used by the next one. A very simple example is if you do a matrix multiplication, and then you need to do a solver, you need to do a, you know, LU decomposition on to in order to solve that matrix, then you know what, you kind of know upfront that the first one will produce, you know what, these, you know, a matrix, and the second one will take the matrix and do the, you know, the solution. On the other hand, you can also have irregular, you know, communication patterns. Sometimes, you know, you don't know exactly what's going to be produced and what's going to be consumed. And you may have a situation where, you know, the precise step that is going to be using the data depends on how the data comes out. So if you have a, you know, situation where you say, oh, you know what, a typical example is in, you know, in some of these molecular dynamic simulation kind of programs, you know, even though you chop up these chunks into roughly the same amount, occasionally you may actually have a situation where one of the partitions has, you know, a little bit too much, okay? And depends on the flexibility of your task structure, you may not be able to handle that very nicely. So in general, in this case, you detect that there is a partition of work that is too much. So you may not finish all that work in your process, but then you raise the event and say, hey, I need to have another module that comes in and clean up the remaining work that I didn't do, you know, so that I can actually, you know what, handle the extra work that happened to sneak into the partition. So there, some of these things that are what we call the event-based, you know, data communication. You know, you may not even know upfront exactly which way, you know, what communication will happen. But as soon as these events start to happen at runtime, you know what, you invoke the right computation step, come in and clean up some of the data structures and then do some things. And there's another, you know what, type of computation that oftentimes have irregular, you know, communication. That is, if your system interacts with the real world, okay, in real-time control or in, you know, in user interfaces, oftentimes, because humans are so unpredictable, you need to have these, you know what, you need to have a more dynamic way of invoking the task according to what user tells you, right? So oftentimes, because there's so many of these things that the user can tell you to do, then instead of, you know, trying to do predetermined vaccination upfront, oftentimes you would just get a user input and then you do a table lookup and you do a, you know, some kind of event, you know, detection, and then you say, ha, this is what needs to be done. So you would typically see table lookups. You would typically see queues and say, okay, I need to do this thing, and then you enter that into the queue rather than having some kind of, you know, a predetermined a function call after the function call, and then you have some data going from function to function, right? So that's the irregular patterns. So these things may actually sound abstract, and in fact, if you read some of the computer science books, these things are very abstract, okay? There are people who spend their lifetime making these things sound abstract. And you know what, when I was a student, I read some of these books, and I said, you know, this is how people spend their life. They actually make simple things sound complex, you know, abstract. So, you know what, engineers should actually take complex things and make them sound simple, right? So, but there are people who make careers out of these, you know, formal definitions and so on. You know, so if you're interested, there are disciplines, you know, there are fields that actually do these kind of things. But you know, it's not the purpose of this class. Okay, this class, the purpose is to make these things as concrete, as practical as possible. So, you know, let's look at, you know, some interesting, you know, situations that happen when you, you know, when you have task, you have data, you have communication patterns that don't necessarily fit well together. Okay, that's the real world. Okay, so you know what? This is the reduction, right? The reduction operator, and you know what? We talk about this in the control flow divergence section. So I brought that out. So this is a situation where we're using a divide and conquer, strategy in the in the computation. So the algorithm itself is a divide and conquer approach. It's not a, you know what, it's not exactly a direct sort of, you know what, chunk approach, in the sense that the amount of parallelism will gradually shrink, okay? As you start, you know, you gradually shrink and shrink and shrink. So the parallel execution is dynamic in the sense that you start with a very large amount of parallelism and then you start, you know, you gradually reduce your parallelism into one, right? However, the CUDA threading model is a linearly decomposed task model. When you invoke a kernel, the kernel wants to know up front, okay, how many threads you have in the X dimension, how many threads you have in the Y dimension in a block, right? And how many blocks are there in the grid? All these things are fixed when you call that kernel function. Make sense? So you will end up with the same number of threads throughout the kernel execution. So that's why this particular model of execution is perfectly suitable for linearly partitioned tasks, right? But not very well suited for divide and conquer style of algorithms. And people will also tell you, if you have something called map reduce, okay, which is, you know, essentially a reduction, okay, if you think about it, it means that when you have a large amount of data, you go through a map phase where you parcel out all the data, okay? So that's the part that you can actually have a lot of parallelism. And then you have a reduced part, which is the reduction part, that where you actually bring your result into a, you know, single result. So, you know what, map reduce is a very frequently used pattern that is a little bit more general than the reduction that we have. It's using a lot of the parallel processing, you know what, system applications. And you know what, you would hear this comment that CUDA is not ideal for map reduce for exactly this reason. The task model, okay, of CUDA is really fundamentally designed for a linearly partitioned part. It's not really well suited for the reduction part, okay? But this is what we got. So in order to program effectively, you know what, we talk about, you know, having these threads, right? So you have threads, you know what, because if you actually take, you know what, you know, each, you gradually reduce the number of threads that you activate through that if condition in the code. However, you know, so it is not really suitable, but there are better ways or worse ways that you can deal with it, okay? And remember, when we use the straightforward way where, you know, we gradually turn off more and more of the threads within the neighborhood, so we start with all even threads and then we turn off the all the threads except for the multiple of fours and except for multiple of eights, then we run into the thread divergence problem in the CUDA model. Okay, whereas if you actually use threads, okay, gradually turning off threads that are far away from each other, then you avoid the thread divergence problem. So even though it's not ideally suited, you can have a much better coping or much worse coping, right? So that is the algorithm, okay? That's part of the algorithm consideration. You need to think about what you're doing each step so that you can actually avoid as much of the mismatch as you can, right? To when you map these things into the real hardware. Okay, so that's one. And if you look at the array multiplication, you know, the tiled algorithm, they are really important for geometric decomposition. Okay, so this is the second part of the of the data partition. So you know what? It turns out that in parallel computing, especially when you have dense, what we call the dense matrix, computation. Dense matrix computation means that if you look at the array or the matrix that you use, you will see a fairly uniform distribution of non-zero items, okay, in that matrix. And that's where we do the traditional linear algebra, we do the traditional solvers and so on. And all these algorithms, all these methods, not algorithms, tend to try to use algorithms that use tiling, okay? Meaning, these algorithms don't just go and then, process the entire rows and entire columns of these matrices. They tend to try to focus on tiles, okay? And for those of you who like history, Wally here is actually one of the pioneers who work on these kind of algorithms many, many years ago, but maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So if you look into literature, there's a very rich amount of literature talking about, these kind of computation, and you will see, his name, in quite a few of these papers. So, a framework, so essentially, when we deal with these, data partitions that are linearly chopped, dense matrices, we would, tend to want to process one entire, one tile at a time. We bring in a tile of data, and we try to squeeze, as much as we can out of that tile of data. So essentially, we bring in this tile of data from N and tile data N, and then, we actually do the computation in each tile of P in such a way that every thread is only going to do a section of computation rather than moving forward with the rest. So this is how you can control the footprint, okay, the footprint usage of data, okay, and by everyone being kind of synchronized with each other, by everyone doing a small section at a time, you actually can more fully utilize, okay, can more fully utilize your data. So, I remember when I was in grad school, I heard a story, okay, and there were three people who actually, in those days, their students were, who really are very constrained financially, right? So, this is a real story, so I'm not going to name names. So, they ran into some financial difficulties, and it was in the 80s, and we did go into a couple of those periods. So the three people decided that if they constrain their footprint in terms of their sleep, then they can actually save money. So this is how they did their tiled algorithm. Okay, so they rented a studio, an efficiency apartment, right? And then there's only one bed in there, right? Three guys. Okay, so then they decided that they will have a synchronized life pattern. So one person will go home and sleep for 8 hours. And then the next shift, right, the next person comes in and sleep for 8 hours. And then the next person sleep for 8 hours. So they arrange, all the three of them are done with classes, so they have very flexible schedule. And then, so they just, decide, which of the 8 hour they sleep. And every month they rotate, okay? And, so by limiting, you know, the things into a more predictable pattern, you can fit all the three guys into one bed, right? If you think about it, right? It's a great constraint footprint, okay? So you know what? It's not just computing, okay? If you really want to save money, you know, there are all kinds of things that you can do. Carpooling, right? Since all these are the same thing. It's all about getting some, coordinating the actions. And you know what, having some, you know, imposing some constraints into each individual task execution so that you can actually share resources better, right? You can actually use things better. Okay? So when you look deeper into it, then you can start to see some further, further opportunity of innovation. So you know what we talked about was what we call the single level tiling, meaning that you tile your data structure, into these partitions, right? And then you just kind of go through them, one by one. But there's also a concept called multi-level tiling, okay? And this is one of the examples. So you know what? If a clever person looked at this problem, and the person was saying, aha, okay, even though I save a lot of memory references by sharing a single tile among, multiple threads, I actually see another interesting opportunity. Okay, I see another interesting opportunity. So if you look at the if I look at two corresponding elements in P in the neighboring tiles, okay, then I see that in order to generate the left, the left hand P element, I need to take one, section of N and one section of N, right, from the tiles, from the, let's say the blue tile, in order to generate a little bit of result for that, P. And if I look at my neighbor tile, okay, another thread is working on the right-hand element, right? That element also needs to take the same section of M, but a different section of N in order to do the computation. So you say, huh, if I somehow use one thread to process both elements at the same time, then I can actually, every time I load access an element of M, I can use it two times in the same thread. So I can actually put that element into a register, okay, and further reduce the memory usage, okay? And I only need to move that data even from the shared memory to register only once. And then I use it out of the register, right? So this is called register tiling, okay? You have another level of combining tiles so that every thread will actually process two tiles, okay? Two elements in the result. And that allows you to even better utilize your memory bandwidth, okay? And the best library algorithms, such as the Intel, what they call the math kernel library, and the best numerical algorithms, oftentimes use multiple levels of tiling, each targeting a different memory, hierarchy level, okay? So that's why you also hear terms as, cache tiling, register tiling, and so on, okay? These things are not, I would say, very well defined in terms of exactly what you do. So, that's why I'm teaching these things in terms of patterns, okay? But, in general, you will see similar kind of, strategies that you would have some kind of tiles, and then you will combine tiles in some way, or you would chop up tiles in some way in order to make use of an even higher level or smaller you know, level of the memory hierarchy. Okay. So that's algorithm. So you know I hope that I have shown you is that, you know, the bits and pieces that we have shown you in the examples, okay, as we talk about CUDA model and so on, you will begin to see where they come from. Okay. They're coming from somewhat more general framework where you can actually see how the various algorithms are placed into that space. And you will see that the particular model, the CUDA threading model, the CUDA memory model, and so on, they are design points within that space, okay? They are particularly picked to be very, very suitable for certain type of data structures and certain type of, you know, tasks. But they are less suitable for some others. So by really understanding this, and when you actually start to craft your program for this model, then you can explicitly deal with it. You can see, this is something that should be very suitable. So I already know that, you know, there are tiling, you know, approaches and so on that I should be able to do very, very well on this architecture. Okay. So, you know, sometimes just knowing that you should be able to do very well already set you ahead of others. And then you may have a situation where you say, okay, this is what my professor asked me to do. At least you can, you know, during the meeting, you can set the expectation of your professor and say, I know so-and-so said, you know, GPUs will give you 200 times speed up. But here is the problem that Professor Hu taught me that, you know, that it's not going to map that well into the GPU. So, you know, maybe expect about 30 times or less, okay? And then, you know, don't fire me if I don't get more than 10 times, right? Because sometimes, you know, you will need to really, you know, be able to rationally tell how much effort that you're going to have to put in and how much return you're going to be able to expect, okay? And this kind of thinking is exactly what you need to do to have in order to, you know, to have that kind of capability. And so let's, you know what, look at another pattern. Okay, this is called the, I call the double buffering pattern. Well, what we used to call prefetching, but, you know, prefetching has a lot of different connotations. So, you know what, I would just call this double buffering. And, you know what, it's a very frequently used approach to allow you to trade off your footprint. Okay, you trade some enlarged footprint for better parallelism. Okay, so, you know what, let's take a look at the array multiplication example, okay? So, you know what, if you look at your tile code, I assume that it looks like the left-hand side, okay? So, you have a loop, okay? And then, you know, in the loop, you load the current tile into that shared memory, okay? Then you do a sync thread, okay? Sync thread, there are two underscores in front of it. And then, after the sync threads, you know that all the threads have done their job loading the tile, right? Everyone is loading one element of n and one element of n, right? So after the sync thread, you know that everyone in the block has done the job. So now everyone go and enjoy that tile in the shared memory. So you do the compute. And then you sync thread and make sure that everyone is done. Right? Everyone is done consuming the data. Before you go back and load another tile, which will overwrite that the previous tile. So you have to make sure that you do the synchronization before you go and override it. You need to make sure everyone is also done with it, right? So, you know what? Another approach that you can take is by saying, you know, the reason why I couldn't go ahead and load the next tile is because I would overwrite the tile if I went and do the next one. So if I provided the storage for two, right, then intuitively I should be able to go ahead and load the next tile when all the threads are still, you know, some of the threads are still consuming the first tile, right? So by providing twice the amount of space, I should be able to go ahead and load the next tile while everyone is still consuming the first tile. And that should give me a lot of improvement because now I overlapped the, you know, the loading and the consumption of data, right? It's less critical in the GPUs, but it's very critical for the CPUs. The reason is when you have a CPU parallel program, remember CPUs are not heavily threaded, okay? The CPUs tend to execute a very small number of threads. So being able to, you know, overlap the, you know, the loading of the tile and the computing of the tile allows the CPU to much better utilize the hardware resources. In the GPUs, it tend to be less critical because you can conceivably have multiple blocks, okay, multiple thread blocks in the same SN. So you may have one thread block that is doing this part, the compute part, okay? But then you could have another block that is actually doing the loading part. So having these kind of, you know what, shifted execution timing across blocks allows you to fully utilize the execution resources in your GPU, okay? That's the reason why it tends not to be critical. However, even in the GPUs, if you could actually give yourself a more, you know, you can allow yourself to have more overlap computing and loading, you can actually go into a situation where your sync thread, okay, your sync thread execution is going to be impose less overhead. So let me explain. So on the right-hand side, what I'm doing is exactly what we talked about. So you know what? You will first load a new tile. Okay, so when you start, you load one tile into the shared memory. Okay? As soon as you go into the loop, you will, you know what, from the global memory into the registers, and then you write that the tile into the shared memory. So then you do a sync thread. So after the sync thread, you will have one tile, okay, in the shared memory. But then after the sync thread, instead of consuming what you have, you immediately start to load the next tile, okay, into that additional location, right? So you have the next tile, right, that be loaded. So, but when you load the next tile, you don't use it, okay? You don't use it. Remember, the thread will be switched out if you are waiting for a global memory access, you waiting to use a global memory data that you load, you're loading. So don't use it, but go ahead and compute based on that previous tile, okay? So you will be loading a new tile into registers, but you're not actually doing the computation, you're not consuming the data, then you're consuming the data that you loaded a while back. So it's more likely you're gonna be able to proceed because the data is more likely gonna be there, right? And then you will do a sync thread to make sure that you truly have consumed the previous tile. Okay, and then you go and deposit, okay, the tile that you just loaded from here into the shared memory, and then you go ahead and load the next tile. So when you do this kind of computation, you're creating more instructions within each thread that will be likely ready for execution. Okay, so you'll have more instructions independent of these low latency loads that are going to be ready for execution. So that also means that by the time you do the sync threads, a lot of these, you know what, the latencies that you need tend to be more uniform and tend to have less variation because a lot of the, you're not really waiting until the usage of this load and which can have a very high variation. So by the time you do the sync thread, a lot of these loads are probably already done so that the additional time you spend waiting on the sync thread will be reduced. And if you're familiar with the synchronization, it means that you're going to have every thread in the thread block to reach that point. And every time, you're going to have fewer and fewer and fewer threads in execution, right? So being able to have sync thread to, you know, for the threads to wait less amount of time in the sync thread means that you can actually improve the resource allocation, resource usage of the SAMs. And this, even in the presence of multiple thread blocks, this can still improve the performance. And so that's why, you know what, oftentimes, if you look at the more advanced tile programs, people will use this kind of double buffering, okay? There's a cost to this. The cost is that oftentimes you end up consuming more registers, okay? You end up consuming more registers and more shared memory locations, right, with this kind of method. So this goes back to what I was talking about a little while back. Sometimes when you use more registers, more shared memory, you may end up being able to accommodate fewer thread blocks in your SM. However, by consuming more shared memory and more registers, you're also able to have more independent instructions within each thread. So, you know, that's why I went through that little calculation in the threading model section, right? And you know what? Sometimes it actually pays off. And when the reason why it pays off is that the independent instructions more than compensated for the loss of thread blocks, okay? And that's where you win, okay? So, yes?
So what is the difference between the log 2 and last block?
Yes.
The difference between the devoted to the shared memory and log next part to the problem.
Okay. You know what? In your code, what you really need to do is you need to load a globe. You know, well, let's say in the matrix multiplication, right? When you load an M element, you first load it into an automatic variable, and then you will. Okay, I see what he's asking. So you know what? In the C expression, what you can have is you can have a global array M and N, let's say, and you move that into a shared memory location. But what you would need to do in this particular approach is that you will load into an automatic variable first, okay? And then the automatic variable, you write the automatic variable into the tile, into the shared memory array. The reason why you do that is because, you know what, you can actually, you know what, when you load into the register here, okay, if you load the global memory content into the automatic variable rather than writing it directly into the shared memory, you're not consuming the data that is being loaded from the global memory. Okay? So your thread will not be stuck until that data is really needed. That is when it actually gets placed into the shared memory, okay?
So whenever I log data from global memory to the automatic variable,
yeah.
So the thread will wait until the data comes into the...
No, the thread will not wait. When you load into a register automatic variable, that as long as you don't use the automatic variable, the thread will continue to execute. It gets stuck when you try to use that automatic variable. That it's a subtle point, but you know, I'm glad you asked. Any addition? No? Okay. Any other questions? Good. Okay. So you know what? The next slide is really for your benefit. So you can actually, you know, look at the blue and orange, and you can, you know, just look at the code. And actually, you know, look at how each step, you know, you'll be loading the, you know, you will be depositing the tile on the register into the shared memory, and you know, the blue tile, and then you will, you know, do the synchronization. You will load the orange tile, and then you will compute the blue tile. Okay, and then you would, you know, deposit the orange tile into the shared memory after synchronization. There's a synchronization after the compute. So, you know, I think it will be very beneficial for you to actually work out a small example and just see how the, you know, how the loading and depositing actually coordinate. So that's pretty much, you know, the kind of, you know, the connection between the algorithm considerations with some of the things that we already talked about. And we will continue to actually look at these algorithm structures as we go through the application case studies, okay? But here, I'm going to use a new example to illustrate some of the communication pattern kind of things and some of the, you know, the fundamental trade-offs, because our examples up to this point are not quite rich enough to illustrate, you know, some of these, you know, more communication-oriented points. So the example that I'm going to use is actually from a video encoding algorithm. So for those of you who, you know, who like to watch, you know, MPEG, you know, movies, right? So, you know, this is the software that is behind the encryption, and you know, when the digital cameras actually, you know, take these MPEG movies, there is a little encoding mechanism in there that will compress the picture pixels into a MPEG compressed form, and this is the compression, you know, pipeline. So naturally, you have, you know, essentially you have, you know, the various stages, and you will have, you know, these what are called, they will chop up the picture into what they call the macro blocks, and then the, so you know what, if you take a movie, then each movie is essentially multiple frames, okay, that gets played very fast, and then in each frame they will chop up the picture into these little chunks, and it's called macro blocks. These macro blocks will go through what they call the motion estimation, meaning that they will actually take a previous picture and then, you know, and say, okay, I know how to encrypt the previous picture, and the new picture, if I can find out that a good part of the new picture is only a small increment from the previous picture, I can perhaps move the person, you know, from this picture to this picture by just moving the coordinate a little bit, right? Or, you know, if I have, you know, like something like this, then, you know, my hand can be moved from one picture to another picture, but the rest of my body doesn't have to, you know, there's no new information for my body, right? So, you know, I can chop my body up and then my hands up so that I can, you know, I can get better encryption. Now, and then you have, you know, this, once you have the motion estimation, you can actually do the motion compensation by generating these little vectors and then say, okay, you, rather than representing the whole thing, you just represent the second picture with the first picture by giving a little bit of vector and say, oh, move this object a little bit, move that object a little bit, and then so on, right? The little chunks a little bit. And then you do the representation, you do the compression, and then you output these, you know, terrible looking bits. But in the end, the other end, you reverse the process and you generate full pictures out of these things. So there are a few interesting things that, you know, people need to do in order to get, you know, to get parallelism to work well in this particular process. First of all, if you look at the MPEG code, okay, if you're interested, you can go to the standards committee and actually get an open source reference implementation of the MPEG program. I can guarantee you, when you look at that piece of code, it does not look like this at all. Okay, you will see a main function, and then, you know, eventually we'll call a pipeline, but the pipeline actually doesn't look like this pipeline. It actually has, you know, multiple levels of loops, and they have conditions, and then you have, you know, things to decide, you know, when to get out of each loop. And after you read it carefully multiple times, you will begin to see there is a kind of a little pipeline going on. But the code is not written that way because of memory usage. Okay, they can actually save memory usage, and I'm going to come back to this point very soon. Okay, so, you know, that's one issue, footprint. Okay, how do you organize your code to have a reasonable footprint. And that footprint, the reasonable footprint, actually differ in parallel and sequential. If you don't need to have parallelism, you can reduce your footprint in general a lot more aggressively than if you need to have parallelism. Okay? And the second one is, oftentimes, you can have, you know, different ways of, you know, doing the same thing. So, you know what, the motion estimation, you know what, algorithm does the following. It takes a small chunk of the previous picture, okay? And then it, you know, it takes the current picture with many, many small chunks. But it's kind of in the neighborhood of that other, that chunk in the previous picture. And then you kind of go around and say, you know, is any of these chunks similar to what I had in the previous chunk, right? So that I can actually encode one of these chunks with the previous chunk, right? Make sense? So the search, there's a searching part that actually takes the thing. You're taking the Cinderella glass shoe, and then you're, you know, fitting all the feet, right, in the kingdom. So you know what? You can do what we call the heuristic search. You can go to, you know, one place, and then if it doesn't match, you decide where to go next. And that usually is a very efficient way, because depending on what you found out, you can decide, you know, where to go. And this, you know what, the most effective way that people use today is called diamond search algorithm. And, or you can just say, I'm going to fire up, you know, all these, you know, all these blocks, all these threads. And each thread will take the block from the previous picture and compare that against one of the little chunks in the current picture. And I'll do all that match at the same time. But I don't have the benefit of knowing what I have seen so far and kind of direct myself to the more likely target. So I'm just essentially using a machine gun approach to just shoot, right? Shoot everyone and one of them will be dead, right? So, you know, that's kind of the parallel approach. It turns out that if you don't have enough execution resources, doing the true parallel search can actually be slow, because you know what, you end up doing a lot more work. But if you have a huge amount of parallel resource, then doing the true parallel approach can be faster, because you know what, you can actually do everything in one step rather than 3, 4, 5 steps, right? So you can think about it this way: if you have 100 blocks, right, and if you have 100 execution resources theoretically doing one step, and whereas in a heuristic approach, you take a step and then you take another step, it may take you 4 or 5 steps to get to where you will need to be. So it's one step versus 4 or 5 steps. However, if you only have two processing units, then it takes the 100 tasks would now require 50 time units to just go through the execution unit. The 50 is a whole lot slower than the 3, 4, right? And you say, oh, this is stupid. You know, I know this. This is, you know, not difficult at all. It turns out that in the various disciplines, this happens all the time. You have multi-grid methods. You have single-grid methods. The multi-grid methods are essentially the heuristic search kind of things. You will take a few steps, but the single grid methods are a lot more parallel, and people run into this kind of problem all the time. And you know what, until they listen to some of these simple things, sometimes they don't even realize that that's the kind of trade-off that is tripping them. So now, you know what, let's look at the communications pattern, okay? So this is that data flow, okay? The third part, the data flow, you know, part of that algorithm organization. So it turns out that for every thread, you want to have the motion estimation to feed into motion compensation and so on. So there are some, you know, implementation decisions that you can make. You can say, well, I'm going to use a kernel, a CUDA kernel to implement motion estimation, okay? So in this kernel, I'm going to actually, you know what, take the micro block from the previous picture, and I'm going to match it against all the blocks, right, in the current picture, right? And then I'm going to generate a motion, a vector for every possible one, right? A conclusion for every possible one. And I send all that conclusion to the motion compensation part. This requires a large amount of storage because you need to store the conclusion of each one in a memory location, right? So by taking the entire step in a kernel, you need to actually write all the conclusions of every macro block into a global memory location, and then you read them all in for the motion compensation part, okay? And that can be a large amount of footprint, and that would potentially limit your performance, okay? So that's why oftentimes people don't necessarily chop up all these things into separate kernels, okay? The memory footprint. Now, you can also combine these steps into a single kernel. You can just write a kernel, and each thread will do a motion estimation part, and then will feed that result directly through registers, right, into the next chunk of code in the same thread, in the same kernel. So you don't need to preserve the conclusion of that first step into the global memory and then read them back in. In the same kernel, you will do the motion motion estimation, and then you will just immediately consume the result by doing the motion compensation. This is a very memory efficient way, and this is essentially how the reference implementation for the single thread execution actually works. And the code is quite messy, but it's very efficient, but there's also a problem. The problem is the motion compensation, and so on, code is not as small as I made them look in this picture. Each step can have hundreds or thousands of instructions. Okay, it's a fairly complex piece of code in each one. So by doing these things, by having all these things in one kernel, sometimes you will make the kernel too big in terms of instruction cache and so on. But you may actually damage the, you may have a situation where multiple kernels, not multiple cache blocks or warps are going to require different part of the kernel, and they don't fit into the instruction cache of SM anymore. So when you execute a very large kernel, this kernel may be executed in different phases by different warps, and they will all fight for that same instruction cache space. And suddenly you may start to run into performance problems because your instructions are no longer accessed from cache. This can actually happen because this phenomenon is happening because, remember, the current generation of GPUs are really fundamentally graphics processors. And in graphics, people don't write very big kernels. People write a small kernel that process a triangle, it process a little pixel, and so on. People tend not to write very big kernels, very complex kernels. And that's why the hardware is not designed to accommodate very big piece of code. So you need to be careful when you arrange your execution. You may think that you're very clever, you're conserving the memory bandwidth to the global memory, and then you run your code, it may not be as fast as you hope for, and you scratch your head, and I can tell you this is one of the reasons why that may be happening. Okay, so you can also have this spatial computing model where you can execute multiple kernels at the same time, and then you can have one kernel feeding the next kernel all running into the SM. This is not currently supported in CUDA, okay? But this particular phenomenon is one of the reasons why people are arguing for supporting simultaneous execution of multiple kernels in the GPU. Because theoretically, if you arrange these things right, you can have one kernel passing information to another kernel, and the other kernel is running, right? So you can consume that information right away so that you don't need to deposit the information out to the global memory and then bring them all back when you launch the next kernel. So this is actually one of the, you know, the reasons why people are arguing passionately about having multiple kernels and having some kind of communication mechanism between kernels in the future CUDA implementations. So one more thing. Oftentimes, your algorithms will have some kind of heuristic, okay, to make things more efficient. So this is one example. The example here is that, when you do the search, okay, when you have an object, right, and you want to do, you want to find out where that object might be in the next picture, you actually shouldn't have to totally randomly search in the next picture. You know, if you find that object in the next picture, it should not be too far away, right? It shouldn't be too far away from where it was in the previous picture. Another way of looking at it is that if you have something that is next to you in the picture, and you just found this something, that traveled a small distance, and if there's another something else right next to that something, then it's likely it's going to be traveling the same amount of distance, because both may be two parts of my hand, right, in the picture. So if one part of my hand travels by a certain distance, the other part of my hand, hopefully, is traveling about the same amount of distance, unless you're looking at a war movie or something that, something happened, right? So you will have a heuristic that when you actually search for the next block, you don't need to start totally from random. You can take the vector that you derive either from the same, from the neighboring block, or you can actually preserve what you saw in the previous picture. So in the heuristics that people use, they actually use the neighboring block. But that requires you to process one block at a time, and then use the current block vector and use it for the next block. And that introduces sequentiality. That means that you cannot handle all the macro blocks in your picture in parallel. However, if you use all the vectors that you remember from the previous picture, then you can start the search of every block in parallel. However, this requires you to remember all the vectors from your previous picture that use up a lot more memory. Okay? So again, this is a trade-off. Okay? So this concludes the algorithm part. And starting next time, we're actually going to take you through several real applications and start to apply a lot of these things into the real situations. See you.